Welcome to the Interracial Dawn Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined as always.
But I'm into the jingle palette. Sorry. Oh, it's going to break down again.
You're very white.
It'll break down. I'm sorry. But.
And you're very white indeed, as evidence of what.
No, is it? Oh, sorry, it was always break down on cops. I don't know, it'll break down.
It's cops that always breaks down on. And sometimes sorry also.
Sometimes.
It's sorry. That's why. What's going on?
I thought you had to do the, if it's your first time.
Oh, I just say hi, whatever, to you first, and then I usually do that. But you just went on some tirade instead.
I ain't got no tirade. But that, please, you know me. That was a tirade. Stop. It was like a whimperade.
A whimperade. Anyways, if this is your first time joining us, welcome. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial Dawn. That's JAWN. Or you can go to our website, interracialdawn.com. And you can also hit us up on any of the social media access points you have, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, at Interracial John. And you can also send us feedback. Oh, and we also use hashtag the John if you happen to be tweeting or posting about the show. You can leave us feedback on iTunes or Stitcher. You can also email us, interracialjohn@gmail.com, and you can call us 657-JOHN or 657-JAWNERS. And I think, I'm not sure.
What, you doing okay?
I'm doing fine. Are you doing okay?
I think so, but there's...
Uh-oh.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
It happened.
It's been a while.
Philly, no less. Villanova. Greasing the poles.
Laser, 1, 2, 3, 4, ain't got shit.
Five stars.
She's just so loud, it like blows me out.
It really is ridiculous. That's what she said.
Get Your Life, 5 stars by Bradford and Sons. Thank you. Drew and Leslie bring the realness every episode. Their on-air chemistry is great, and their collective knowledge and passion around the issues they address on the show is unsurpassed. Well, thank you.
Wow.
Maybe a little bit hyperbole there, Bradford and Sons. From Cop... A little punchy today. From pop culture to the struggle for black liberation, they got you covered. Get Your Life in order to put them in the regular rotation.
Hey, regular rotation.
Oh, there's two. Double up.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, where's my bell? Wait.
Did you get a ring and bell for number two?
I can't find my bell. My bell.
I'll give you a
waist clap.
Waist clap. A second review. Your bell is.
I found my bell.
I know you take it off your desk because you ring it at random intervals.
It's always like every now and then I'll just be like, bling, bling.
Somebody was like, what's that for? I'm like, that's what makes sales. It's a sales bell. Bing. Bells are for closers.
That's right.
Okay. You Guys Rock by Michael Lear. Michael Lear, I guess. I have listened to you guys for years. I should say, forgive me if that's Michelier or Michael Lear or Michelier. I think it's Michelier.
Michelier. Michelar.
Michelar. Forgive me for butchering your name. I apologize. Write us and tell me how to pronounce it and I'll do it better. Have listened to you guys for years, so forgive me for taking so long to leave a review. Oh, you're totally forgiven. The John was one of my first podcasts. Love your super smart, funny take, no prisoners approach to discussing race and the topics of the day. Please keep doing what you're doing. Your voices are necessary and important. High five.
Hey. All right,
yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.
That's so great. We also have some other
communiques. Did one of them be an email?
First we have some we have a voicemail.
Okay,
so I'll play that first. Let's see here.
I'll adjust the audio on my end.
Okay. Whoop. Is it playing? Play. Oh wait, is it MP3? It like downloaded. Wasn't expecting that.
Hi, Drew and Leslie. My name is Janine, a.k.a. Scrum Master Flash on the Twitter. Just wanted to call and let you guys know I just finished episode 142, and the pure joy in your voices when you're playing Union or onion is just infectious. I love that segment. I'm also 2.5 episodes into Imposters. Thank you, Leslie, for that recommendation.
Oh, that show's so good. Just it's coming back soon.
Long-time listener, first-time caller, wanted to call and tell you guys how much I love the show. I'm really glad that you guys are back in full swing and delivering regularly again, and I get it that you guys have lives outside of the podcast, but it's really great as a fan to have you back regularly. You know, just wanted to take a second and reach out and say that the Johnners out here love you, and I'm going to, next after this, give you a 5-star review because that's way overdue. I have not paid my dues. So appreciate everything you do. Keep doing what you're doing, and thanks again.
Thank you so much. Aww, oh my God, that's so sweet. Oh my goodness.
I'm touched.
That was great.
Okay, this is like 12:30 fuck-ass crazy Michigan commercial, take one.
I don't know. I don't know what's playing right now.
Why was that playing from your phone?
It was like when I opened the MP3, like it just started playing things.
What was it, a Michigan commercial playing?
I don't know. Just
let it go.
I don't know where it was. It went away. I closed it.
That's like a bated breath. That was me like talking about something crazy.
See, I think it's one of those crazy Michigan commercials.
Go to downloads.
I don't know where it is. I don't know what it is.
My life is incomplete right now.
Is it?
Yeah.
It'll be all right. You'll live.
I'll get over it in about 30 seconds. But. I'm curious, though.
Stop. You're making me laugh too much. I can't even be serious. Anyways, now we do have some emails.
Now what the are you saying to us?
I see how to play that again.
Now what the are you saying to us?
Only because that was...
Van.
Was it Van?
It was Van.
At, was it Black in Chicago?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a woman who... I don't think she works there anymore. Or does she? No.
She does still work there, I think.
But she had some really like... I won't even repeat them, just like obscene, ridiculous, like horribly ridiculously outdated views about HIV and how it's transmitted. And even Van was like, what the fuck are you saying to us right now? Like, what are you saying? This is really outlandish shit.
It's hilarious. So funny.
Well, let's hear the email.
All right, here we go. So the first one is from LaTanya. So this is a little disjointed. Hopefully LaTanya listens. She's actually a friend of mine who doesn't listen to podcasts. This may be the first one she's ever listened to. So here we go.
Okay.
She says, I agree with Drew. The more LaTanya knows, be gentle because I wasn't fully getting it. I'm learning. And that's the beauty of hearing this podcast for the first time. I don't listen to podcasts. I might be so inclined, but I'm not even sure how to know where to start. Couldn't even direct others to how I found this second time. So she just, this is her first podcast she's ever listened to. Now I feel bad because her... Last week we were away, and so for those, hopefully y'all are listening to multiple shows, but instead of a new show this past week, I actually rebroadcast, basically I put back on the feed our very first episode. So now she listens to our first episode as her first podcast ever.
What?
And
meta.
Like, my mind is blown right now. But hopefully, shout out to you, LaTanya. Thank you for writing in.
Yeah, I remember, like, I think I went and listened. Truthfully, I don't listen to our own podcast at all. I used to on occasion for like kind of like feedback and like, oh, I did this well, we did that well, the sound wasn't this, the sound wasn't that. And now I've gotten to the point like I was there. We did it. I don't need to listen to it. So I don't really listen to our own show. But the first one, the audio was terrible. It was like an open air mic.
Well, we were just like playing around.
I know.
As bad as you say. I mean, I listen to some podcasts. The quality sound is not much better than that.
Well, I tried from the get-go.
Yes, you did. And you've gotten better and better. Anyways, we have a second one from one of the Faithful 14, indeed. Feedback, sort of.
Are you saying to us?
Gotta get it again.
From Hannah. Hey, Hannah. She says, hi, first, I'll admit that this letter has been on my mind for 6 months. I first planned to write and ask about Leslie's thoughts on the trip to Jamaica that Karen on TBGWT waxed poetic about last year. But then life happened. We were denied adoption, resumed infertility treatments, and then had a miscarriage. Lots of shitty shit. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Hannah. I love listening to you anyway. I'm actually glad you are not dwelling on the current president of the U.S. He is taking over all the news all the time. So it's nice to think of something else once in a while. I think Leslie's policy of talking about politics only in very select instances is good. I hope you're doing well despite all the upheaval in that aspect. The trip to Santorini sounded awesome. I have to agree with you that seeing places without the 1 million Western tourists is way better, even if it is off season. Weather can be horrible on some days. I've not traveled in Europe except Helsinki, London, St. Petersburg, and Brussels. But I think after your recommendation, Greece is on some version of my bucket list. The denied adoption part actually is an interesting story, I think, though I guess it's not so close to you since you are happily child-free. Our story is a mixture of money can't buy you everything and deep prejudice against mental illness. Someone might remember that I live in Finland, so this might not apply to US, but it might be entertaining anyway. So there are two MDs, male and female, one biological child, own a house, and student loans are paid. We applied. She said they are both MDs. We applied for international adoption, which I know can be very complex with racism, cultural sensitivity, trauma, and many other kinds of things. Did my mic sound weird there for a second?
I'm adjusting the audio.
Okay, just making sure.
No problem. It was too loud in my ears. Is okay, it okay for you?
No, it's fine. It now. No, it's fine. I just was making sure I didn't touch something wrong or something.
No,
like
it was like popping in my ears.
Own a home and student loans are paid. We apply for international adoption, which I know can be complex with racism, cultural sensitivity, trauma of many kinds, and the way we privilege or blind to our privilege and how it impacts even our own family. We were hoping to adopt from the Philippines since I lived there for 5 years as a child. In Finland, adoption is part of the universal health care, so there are virtually no small children or babies to be adopted from Finnish families / parents. The abortion services are readily available. So in a way, every child born is quote unquote wanted. Since our child is young, we cannot adopt a teenager. And since I've been inoculated with a lot of Filipino culture, I guess I might have been an okay parent for someone trying to straddle the world between Asia and Northern Europe. My main concern was for not being able to make my child European enough. I still mostly prefer Filipino food, TV, and music over others at home. But I guess with a purely Finnish father and a society completely Finnish, the child would have been more native here than I ever will be. I think it is an interesting thing to think about how much parents are able to bring their own culture to their kids when living in a very different culture at school and with friends. That's really interesting to me because I'm a first generation immigrant. So my family, definitely my mom, you know, and my sisters and my grandmother, my grandparents, the rest of my family definitely made a concerted effort to make sure, like, I would say one of my probably the strongest cultural identifier I have is that I'm Jamaican. Would you agree or no?
Without doubt.
Like, I'm without like, doubt. Yeah, like, we're like very Jamaican.
I've said to other people that, like, in the beginning, this is going back 20 years, but people would be like, describing as African American. I said, that's not correct. She's not African American. That's not a identity that she identifies personally. She's Jamaican, which has to mean she's black. And she's first generation immigrant. She's black Jamaican. There you go. Doesn't mean African American. Very different.
Yeah.
Not very different, but it's just it is a different part of the diaspora.
Yeah. Sorry, I just was jumping in with that. Anyways, I think my own parents were somewhat able to keep me at least culturally competent in Finnish, even if my actual cultural identity is a weird mishmash. I guess Leslie knows what I'm talking about, with the contradictions of family culture and traditions and school and friends and what's on TV, etc. I'm not Dolezal. I have no fantasy that I'm anything but white and European. I think that in that regard, there are actually some faint similarities in my experience and those of POC in the US. I lived immersed in a local society. The only other white person people I knew were my parents and siblings. I only use European language with my parents. Even with my siblings, we use the local dialect. But always there was moments when it was painfully obvious to everyone that I was the other. Ultimately, I did not belong. Those moments were never dangerous. They're mostly funny, sometimes awkward, but it was traumatic when you're like 13 with bad acne. And there are a few things worse than knowing with absolute certainty that you're an outsider and you will never truly belong in a group that your friends belong to. In a way, I wonder if it is better that I cannot adopt internationally since I'll be forcing and repeating the traumas of my own life on my child. Ooh, that's heavy. Mm. Then again, no childhood is perfect. And I always a wish for parents to understand their children and share things with my kid.
Well, in terms of, is that the end of the email?
No, there's more. Sorry. Is that okay?
Let's keep going. Yeah,
okay.
Ahead.
My blue eyed blonde biological child growing up upper middle class with only other white people is sometimes a total stranger to me. My parents were nowhere near middle class. We were always one paycheck from starving. I think it's only natural for parents to wish to see something of themselves in their child. So in that respect, I'm actually I'm not actually sorry for my wish to adopt from my childhood country. Anyway, we never got that far in it. We had 3 interviews with 1 social worker, and then we're told that we were definitely not suitable to adopt anyone. I've had depression, and that is the reason I went to therapy for 3 years. And after the depression was triggered by me almost dying during our first round of infertility treatments. So I had thought that it might be an issue that I could be accepted as past and over. What decided our caseworker against me was me mentioning that when 3 months before high school graduation and 1 month before A-levels, the test to determine where you can go to school for university, my parents moved to a city 500 miles away. And I was also at that time a bit depressed. The interpretation was that I get depressed whenever life gets hard. I get depressed. So adoption is a no-no. Adopted children are traumatized and must have a very stable environment to grow up. It's just it's nice to know that they're here. Vetting is rigorous and you cannot buy a baby. Then again, I think that if you get your first apartment all alone, start your first real job, your parents are for the first time in your life more than 10 miles away from where you are 1 month before tests that determine what university goes, you're allowed to cry 4 times. The extent of my depression during those A-levels was crying myself to sleep 4 times. The depression I had after almost dying during infertility treatment was the real deal. Lost 20 pounds, couldn't sleep, lost friends, suicidal thoughts, etc. But it was 8 years ago and the depression never came back with a colicky baby or a miscarriage or losing the dream job. Just turned out to be into a journal of sorts. You can read some of it or none of it. Oh, this turned out to be a journal of sorts. No, thanks for sharing, Hannah. This is the danger of having someone in your head every week. You begin to think of them as your friend, even though they have no idea who you are or wish to know who you are. Oh, that's not true.
She says that so we show up at her door.
We're going to be like, knocking on your door Aurora any Borealis. Day now.
We want to see the Northern Lights. Don't think we're not. Especially because you ordered and said like that's like common and they treat like visitors like super dope and yeah, it's awesome.
I'm ready for all of those things. There's more on the adoption. That's a part two. When I compare my experience to the adoption agency, there's only 1 agency in a 600 mile radius. We live almost at the North Pole, so we cannot ever reapply. To the news in California with those parents driving off the cliff with their adopted kids, I do feel a lot of things. Of course, the U.S. is the U.S. and the system there is very different, but still, to me, it feels like people who acknowledge their demons seek and get help and then are open about it get needlessly labeled as defective or crazy or unstable, but then many times actually live very healthy and stable lives because the help actually helped compared to people who uphold a facade of being noble and ideal, bury all the skeletons under the floorboards, and then snap and do something truly horrible. I think for an adopted child, if the choices were only between parents who need to get therapy once in a while compared to parents who actively abuse and then kill you, I think the choice is obvious. Thankfully and hopefully the situation mostly is a choice between a happy, healthy home and good functioning foster care. Hannah. So there's a lot. I'm sure you have a lot to say there. Yeah.
Remember in Parenthood when Keanu Reeves is like, any asshole can have a child.
Right.
And that's the truth.
Yeah.
But to adopt is very, and I respect Hannah for acknowledging the issue with transracial adoption, some of the complexity and doing some of the work necessary, you know. I think the fact that they got barred because of 1, you know, mental health comment is a little outrageous, but that's the stigmatization that exists with mental health. And even we have friends and I've had experiences where it feels like the system has 2 options. They want you to do 1 of 2 things, kind of like institutionalize yourself or going for a 72-hour hospitalization is one of them. And, you know, at one point I was like, oh, yeah, we can see you in like 6 weeks.
Right.
And I'm like, geez, Louise, six weeks. Go ahead and check yourself into the ER. Is there something in between? Like, is it pretty, like, I understand those are 2 options, but like, there's nothing in between? The fuck? You know? And I know a variety of people that have been in that experience. So it's a terrible way mental health is treated and stigmatized. Mm-hmm. So what's your thoughts on Hannah's letter?
Oh, no, I said all the things. I stopped in the middle of it every time and said what I had to say. But thank you so much for writing in, Hannah. We do care to hear about you, and we will literally be knocking at your door any day now.
And take care of you, you know. Do the things that are best for you. You know, when you're depressed, don't lean into it. Kind of do non-depressive things. You know all the stuff that's right. Drink your water, whatever, take your meds. But be healthy and don't be afraid to be strong in your health.
But I do think that there's this thing around, you know, disclosing and what that means. And
yeah, this had deep implications, lamentably.
But I think it always does on some level. I mean, you've talked about that. I mean, otherwise everybody would be very open about their mental health, right?
Yeah.
There's a reason why. It's not just a social stigma. I think that there's an additional stigma of like actual consequences and people, you know, opportunities lost and decisions being made for you that you wouldn't make or listen, all sorts of things.
I've been in the room where family members are talking about mental health and diabetes, and the reaction from other family members is like, horrific.
Mm-hmm.
You know, acting like it's like some sort of death sentence. Like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, whoa, they just said, like, relax. Like, they just have a diagnosis. It's not like, let's not go to that conclusion.
Right.
You know? So even that stigmatization is like, it's like you said, it's terrible. I think there's, if they already haven't done it, insurance companies are going to start perusing, sort of browsing history and things that you looked up, and they're going to be able, there was an app that can tell when you're manic based on what you're doing on social media. And I believe that it's, both the reliability and validity of that is probably pretty accurate, high. I wouldn't be surprised if insurance companies start denying claims based on online behavior.
Mm.
Oh, we think that you're more likely to be depressed or have, you know, this or, you know, suicidal. I don't know what they would do, but they're going to do something. Like you're searching a bunch of stuff about HIV. You know, how do you contract HIV? How do you know if you contracted HIV? Do I have HIV? All of a sudden you're denied for insurance, you know? Like, I'm sure they're doing that.
Yeah, I'm sure. All of that. They're looking for reasons to not allow you to get treatment. I think that's kind of the standard here. Pretty much.
I know we have some Canadian listeners, and I saw one of these Vice shows about Canadians and when they travel here, taking out insurance. Like, there's like a one-week travel insurance because they don't want to get, like, in an accident in America and hit with, like, a $200,000 hospitalization bill. Because they have universal health coverage in Canada, but that doesn't, like, cover them traveling here. Slip on a crack and you're bankrupt.
Absolutely. Sorry. Someone's traveling. They just had a question.
All right.
You want to get to... Let's get into it.
The news?
Let's do it.
The news is coming on. The news is
coming on.
So, the UK has offered to give Ethiopia back its stolen treasures.
I saw this.
On loan.
I saw that too.
The Victoria and Albert Museum in London has agreed to return artifacts taken from Ethiopia 150 years ago on a long-term loan. Where'd they do this at? Only white people.
Mm-hmm.
Ethiopia filed a claim in 2007 asking the UK return ancient artifacts and manuscripts taken in 1868 during the capture of Magdala. These items include a gold crown, a royal wedding dress. Both items were taken from the mountain capital of Emperor Tewodros II in the area formerly known as Ibanisia. And are currently held at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. The Ethiopian government claim was denied by the museum, but director Tristan Hunt suggested another solution, that the looted items be temporarily given back through a long-term loan. The speediest way, if Ethiopia wanted to have these items on display as a long-term loan, that would be the easiest way to manage it. BBC Africa quotes him as saying, the items will be on display at the museum for their upcoming exhibit, Magdala 1868, which will display 20 separate artifacts to commemorate the 150th anniversary of the battle. Now, let me just get this shit straight.
Seriously? Jesus.
I just want to understand. What they're saying here is that they stole this shit. They put together an actual installation celebrating their theft. And then they're going to give it back to them, but only just to hold it for a little while.
Yeah. We're going to build a testament to our fucking thievery. But here, look at it. Touch it. Feel it for just a minute. Isn't that nice?
I just...
We're so magnanimous. So generous. Look at this thing we looted from you. You can touch it. Ooh, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Once you... this dude says you have to take it item by item and have to take it history by history. Once you unpick the histories of the collections, it becomes a great deal more complicated and challenging. He told The Guardian. this article from OK Africa says, we're not sure how complicated it is to simply hand these items back to their rightful owners, but we already know how colonizers operate. If you don't ask, just ask the homie Eric Killmonger. Anyways.
Isn't that like that other one? We read about that museum of the Bible. Like, they'd just be stealing artifacts and
just
shit.
Just white people, like, just running rubshot over. And then when you're calling your shit, it's like, what do you mean? Why?
Don't call me colonizer. Like, literally.
It's a slur.
Stop with a slur. Kansas bill, new one, said they might make schools liable for shootings if they don't arm the teachers.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
This should have went under union or onion because that sounds really ridiculous.
It really should have. But as the debate over arming teachers in schools reverberates across the country, Kansas is doubling down on the idea. Way to go, Kansas. Way to be you. A new bill would not only authorize the arming of Kansas school staff, mm-hmm. it would hold schools responsible if a shooting were to occur and the teachers and staff present were not allowed to be armed. Here's the exact wording from House Bill 2789. In any action against a unified school district arising out of acts or omissions regarding the possession or use of firearms on the premises of such school district, there shall be a rebuttable presumption of negligence.
Wow.
On the part of such school district when it is shown by evidence that such school district did not authorize any employee of such school district other than school security officers to carry concealed handguns. So basically, they're not saying you have to arm the teachers, but if you don't at least allow any one teacher, if all you do is, if you say you're a teacher, you can't have arms.
Oh, if you just prohibit them from doing it.
Yeah. If you allow them and no one carries it, no big deal. But if you've restricted it, now you're liable.
That's, does that even make sense?
That is just, who do you fucking sue? The school district?
I guess.
So now basically a lawmaker is telling your students and the parents of said students, by law, one of y'all got to have a gun in his classroom. Or at least by law, all of y'all are allowed to carry a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember the time when parents were suing, and I don't know, maybe some are, I don't have children, I'm a little too old, but they'd ask like their play friends, when they're like, okay, Jimmy's going to Steve's for the day, and they're both 7, let me talk to Steve's mom. Hi, Steve's mom, do you have guns in the house? Literally, mm-hmm. right? Like, they'd ask that shit. Now you got to go to school. Hey, teacher, hi, Mr. Mac, you got guns in the classroom? 12 gauge under the desk. Try
don't
me.
Worry. Don't worry
Come
about me.
Come at me, bro.
Worry about yourself.
Here's your syllabus. But yeah, that's a lot. That's extreme.
That is very Kansas. Extreme. It's so ridiculous.
Be in Kansas.
I saw this and it was caught my eye because actually I think a lot of the stories I'm going to cover tonight are very much from our old haunting grounds in Jersey. But workers allegedly stiffed out of money at 15 Houlihan's in New Jersey will share $5 million. The owner of 15 Houlihan's restaurants across the state has agreed to pay $5 million. This is from NewJersey.com. $5 million in back wages and damages to more than 1,000 workers after allegedly denying overtime pay and forcing workers to pay twice for shift meals. Oh, Lord. So the U.S. Department of Labor announced the agreement on Monday following a lawsuit against two companies, one in New Jersey and one in New York, that are owned by Arnold Runestad of Bergen County. Surprise. The restaurant.
I bet you I've eaten it at Houlihan's, one of them.
You've eaten at the Cherry Hill one for sure, because that's on the list.
There you go.
So is the Paramus one, and I'm pretty sure we've eaten there as well. Their parent company, Ace Restaurant Group, is based in Saddlebrook, while the other company that he owns operates two Houlihan's in New York between the 17 locations. Anyway, so they're going to... they're going to be sharing this $5 million payout.
Good for them.
I just thought it was interesting.
And, you know, I think, too, that there's going to be more investigation into minimum wage. Because I've been to some, like, let's just be honest. You and I have been in the restaurant industry when we were younger for a decade plus.
Yeah. Right?
Combined, we've got almost 20 years of restaurant experience, both front of the house, back of the house, and managerial.
Yep.
All across the board, right? Like, we know a few things about restaurants. And... to take, like so often, especially servers, get paid like $2.10 an hour, $2.35, and then you're expected to make tips. But if you're the fucking opening server, you come in and do 45 minutes to an hour's worth of work that's yep. at $2.35 an hour.
Yep.
If you're the closing server, same thing. You got yep. a bunch of shit to do all throughout, even before there's people there. Or let's say they overstaffed and they cut you after only two tables.
It's true.
Right? You came in, you were there, you got dressed. So this whole minimum wage and what does that mean for a server, I wonder if that's going to change in places like Seattle, California, and whatnot. But that's dirty and gross and fucked
mm-hmm.
up. I worked for the Ralph Brennan Restaurant Group in New Orleans. They own like all the biggest top restaurants, Commander's Palace, like blah, 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 blah. And they got sued. They got in trouble with the IRS because employees weren't claiming enough tips.
Mm.
Like, listen, yo, you're fucking average meal is $120 a plate, and your servers are claiming like $82 shift. Right. You know, it's like, come on, man. Like, something, the math isn't adding up. And then especially since credit cards became more and more prominent, it's like you can you can see the fucking,
you can see the sales,
you can see the tips,
right? Like, we can see somebody. So only your credit card tables are giving y'all any tips at all? Like,
so that
okay.
So that's exactly what happened. People started claiming only their credit card tables. So they came in, and the Ralph Brennan Group's like solution was like, okay, we'll roll over and give you all the servers, every single fucking one. They audited them all, and they hit one of the people I worked with like a $12,000 fine. Wow. Over the course, it was many years. It was like a 6 or 7 year employment history, but it was like, fuck me, 12 grand from the IRS. And then after that, the like punch out system, it wouldn't allow you to do anything less than like 10% of your total sales. It was like, this is your total sales. Like, these are your tips. Deal with it.
Wow.
You can put in more, but you can't put in less.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Any hoops.
Any poop.
Where are we here? Research. Learning a little bit about something makes us kind of overconfident. Do you ever suspect that at all, talking to white people about race?
Most definitely.
You ever think the one dude that knows that one MLK quote about the content of her character, the color of her skin, makes him like an expert?
FBI chart number 17.
It's 43, but yeah.
Whatever.
So learning a little makes us overconfident. And I think this goes for, I don't mean disrespect to possibly millennial listeners.
Millennials.
But I think this is a significant issue with millennials that I've worked with, where it's like, you know.
What's a millennial to you? Because I feel like people be talking about people in like, the youngest millennial is like 35. So you mean 35-year-olds? Or you're talking about a separate generation that's younger than that currently?
Younger than that, I guess.
Okay, so don't be besmirching millennials on our podcast when you don't mean them.
I guess X, Y, or Z, one of them fucking deeper ones. But just, you know, this it comes off as entitlement because they're overconfident. But as a former baseball pitcher, Vernon Law, once put it, experience is a hard teacher because it gives the test first and only then provides the lesson. Perhaps the observation can explain the results of a survey sponsored by the Association of American Colleges and Universities. 64% said they were well prepared to work in a team. 66% thought they had adequate critical thinking. And 65% said they were proficient in written communication. However, among employers who had recently hired these students, less than 40% agreed on any of these statements.
Wow.
So they went to the actual, they did the like, if you ever been in like Big Fortune, whatever, it's like where you fill out your own review and
right.
then your supervisor fills
out
the
review,
their review,
right?
Compare it and shit. And they're all
they're
over
off.
60.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's like, oh, really? How convenient.
The students thought they were much further along in their learning curve toward workplace success than their future employers did.
Interesting.
Overconfidence in particular among beginners. I don't even need to go further.
Yeah, don't. We all seen that before.
The beginner's bubble.
Wherever we are.
We found that people slowly and gradually learned how to perform the task, though they found it quite challenging. Their performance incrementally improved with each patient. Confidence, however, took quite a different journey, and each study participant started out well-calibrated. How accurate their diagnosis would be to proven to be, they began thinking they were right about 50% of the time when their actual rate was
55%. Mm. Okay. All right.
So they're doing things
so it corrected itself a bit. Interesting.
Oh, I'm sorry. However, after just a few patients, their confidence skyrocketed far ahead of any accuracy they achieved. Soon, participants estimated their accuracy rate was 73% when it still hadn't even hit 60. Mm-hmm. So they were accurate in the beginning, like, yeah, like 50. You nail two of them, you're like, I'm on fire. He's on fire.
So I saw this is another NewJersey.com article, but do you remember that like weird mall Voorhees Town Center we went to like once or twice? It had like a Ritz Theater in it and like random restaurants.
Voorhees, sure.
Yeah, do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Okay, so
it had like a really shitty anchor. Like,
yeah.
Maybe like a Sears if best.
I don't even know. It used to have a Macy's, but that closed last year. So okay. $150 million plan to transform this dying mall into a town center failed. Now what? So this guy, Jason Rabbits, he's like going on about how, oh, we used to go to this mall before it was called Voorhees Town Center. It used to be called Echelon Mall, apparently. Who knew?
Okay. I think I know the word Echelon Mall more than Voorhees. But
yeah, it's a 51-acre property and, zoned. Local officials are considering condemning it and renaming it a redevelopment zone. It won't be the first attempt to revitalize the 48-year-old indoor mall. that has suffered because of its landlocked location and nearby competitors. A decade ago, the mall's former owner, Priet, the Pennsylvania Real Estate Investment Trust, don't you know something about them?
I do, but it's all right.
Okay, embarked on a $150 million project to create a town center from scratch, bringing street-level retail to a new Main Street-type boulevard, as well as condos and apartments above and around. Oh, the whole, like, eat, play, you know, drink... whatever.
Well, and to their, I would say to their credit, but they've done flips of that before. They did like a naval base, like the old racetrack, I bet, was, if not Preet, was one of these other investment trusts. Because you can't do a, like the size of that project, the old racetrack, it's huge.
Yeah, huge.
You can't do that on.
But the glory days that Rivets pines for have never fully returned. Today, four of the five anchor stores the mall had in its prime have shuttered. Wow. And gone dark, and the mall's occupancy is at 50%. Luckily, as a member of the township planning board and elected a member of the township committee, he's in a position to do something about it. He and the other members of the board unanimously agreed last week to forward a study detailing the need to redevelop and condemn the property to the township committee. So,
wow. So the company that bought it, this sort of like equity investor, Nader, came with guns blazing, saying they'd work with the township, invest the town center, and attract new businesses, and unfortunately they haven't followed through on their promise. We couldn't seem to get their attention, said Mario Di Natale, the township director of community and business development and a member of the planning board. They bought 30 malls over the last couple of years, half of them from this Pennsylvania Real Estate Trust and previous owner of our mall. So we're stuck with an absentee landlord, and they're giving our mall, and they're not giving our mall the attention it needed. Wow.
Wow. And so the town center is the township's largest taxpayer, forking over $900,000 a year. He said Voorhees has been able to redevelop it largely with investments from Priet. He and other township officials say a bond to pay for the construction of the new municipal building at the town center was largely paid by increased tax revenue from businesses and residents who moved in during the first phase of redevelopment in 2007. The first phase included mixed use, professional offices, blah, blah, blah. He has a term for what happened on the largest tract of the land of the township, demalling, which is happening in Grand Rapids as well, very close
to
us. We saw
it's done. We drove by it. Yeah.
It's demalled. They've taken it all down. It's gone.
Yeah, but it was totally youth. Same like this. Like same. 50% occupancy. Like one of the tenants was like a little old lady's wig shop. Like it just wasn't good. Wasn't good usage.
Yeah, so basically demolishing is a trend that has developed the last 20 years to reconstruct the retail center model from an indoor shopping experience to an open air, preferably with parking near standalone stores. The open air experience is basically like an outlet mall. That's what they basically
And even it's interesting, the one that I'm talking about, like it's they had such little land, but so instead of just sort of having like a strip mall or a bunch of strip stores, they cut it down like on a diagonal. They cut it in half in this weird sort of truncated way, but you can't drive down that part. That's like pedestrian, and they went into a lot of the other parking spaces, and it's kind of, it looks good. They're like, maybe if not, there's some big freestanding stores like a Rite Aid and a few others, but then you've got like Lululemon and something else sharing a store.
Right,
it looks much the
well those the build the out Lululemon the, everything that the anything new that's gone into that place has been already built like that. Those were never in the mall.
No,
the
but
Lululemon, the other like store, the Anthropology.
Yeah, but it looks like all that now.
I know. That's why you could tell they were going for that. That's what they were.
And it's a much more upscale. I'm sure you can get a much higher price per dollar, you know. And the Rite Aid took that one right on the corner. I was kind of shocked. They got prominent. I guess the pharmacies are always on the corner, but anyway, demalling. So demalling. Is that it? On that
yep, that's it.
For the demalling. This I used to have this issue. I've been working from home so long that I had a telephone phone that was connected to like a modem deal, like a voice over internet protocol, like pre-Skype days. And it would fucking ring at like all kinds of hours, 4 in the morning, 5, because I got clients in Europe. And even if I didn't want to answer it, it's like woke me up and like, now I'm fucking working. Like, that's it. And for even a little while, email would do that. Like, bing, have a little like bing when email comes in. Mm-hmm. So I finally was like, my office was too close. So I shut all that shit down. Now the office is like on a separate floor with a door I closed. So it's a very distinct, like, I'm out. Like, you can't get me, like, no how. But we all got phones and other things. So New York
is possibly instituting a bill that would say New Yorkers may not have to answer email after hours.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I think they have that in France.
I bet you they do.
I think they have that in France, but go on. Exactly.
Getting work emails from your boss when you're off the clock, there ought to be a law against that. Well, in New York, there just might be. Rafael Espinal, a city council member from Brooklyn, introduced a bill last week that would make it illegal for businesses to contact employees via email or instant message when the employees are off the clock.
Hmm.
The disconnecting from work bill would only apply to businesses with 100 or more employees and forbid communication. Workers are off duty, on vacation, using personal days, or off sick. He says there's a lot of New Yorkers out there that don't know when their work day begins and when their work day ends because we're all so tied to our phones, he told ZN. You can still work. You can talk to your boss, but this is just a saying that when you feel like you've hit your boiling point and you can't do it anymore, you're able to disconnect and decompress for a while.
Yeah.
Employers who violate this would pay a fine of $250 per employee. There would be exceptions for employees who work overtime or on call 24 hours a day. Bill's currently in the council's Consumer Affairs Business Licensing Committee, similar to a bill in France, which gives workers the right to ignore business emails that pop up in inboxes after hours. There you go, Leslie, you're right.
See?
He hopes to get the bill through legislation and on there next year.
Yeah.
Office of Nightlife, which oversees New York's night spots and created the city's first nightlife mayor. Huh, interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm here for it. I think it's for me, it's difficult. When you're exempt, because like it said, if it's overtime, but like if you're management, like you just get a salary, I kind of think the expectation is you're accessible at a lot of hours, including after hours. I don't know. I don't see how they could make that a rule for management and salaried employees, but maybe I don't know. That couldn't be for me. I mean, I have clients that are at odd hours. I have a boss that's halfway across the world for parts of the year. Like, there's just no way. We have employees that are on a 12-hour time difference, and I have to talk to them. Like,
right.
Okay, is it going to be 7 a.m. or 8 p.m.?
Or 8 p.m. Right.
It's one or the other, and it's good for neither of us.
Absolutely not. Well, I just saw this article and it was in Vice.com, and it was too many atheists are veering dangerously toward the alt-right, and atheists can't afford to be quiet about it.
I haven't heard this.
Yeah. So it talks a little bit about Richard Spencer, and he posted an interview on his own website titled "The Alt-Right and Secular Humanism," leaving no doubt that he sees atheism and humanism as linked to his cause. Yet I don't know any prominent atheist, humanist, or secular organizations that took the support to condemn Spencer. As someone who has worked in the atheist movement for the better part of a decade, this silence scares me. So the author just talks about when they became an atheist and everything, but they're just talking about the toxic side to internet atheism. For years, women and people of color have repeatedly voiced how atheist websites, organizations, and public figures ignore their concerns and tolerate or even actively contribute to an environment that makes them feel unsafe and unwelcome, particularly online. Given these concerns, it's not surprising that areas of online atheism increasingly seem to be overlapping with the alt-right.
Wow. You know, and I'm just going to take an interjection. You can call these like Bill Maher atheists.
Talk about Bill Maher.
I specifically say they're anti-theist. To me, there's a distinct difference. I classify myself as an atheist. Maybe I go back and forth, agnostic atheist. But that, if you say like, oh, I believe in the Holy Trinity and God and all the, it's like, no, I don't believe in that. So maybe you and I both don't believe in the same thing, but I call myself an atheist, yet I have faith. I go to a church. I'm not an anti-theist. I respect people that have theistic views. You know what I mean? Like, some of my best friends have very theistic views and are very pious individuals, and we get along just fine because I'm not an anti-theist. I'm an atheist.
Do you pray?
So I don't. That's not something I do, but I will light a candle and sort of tell someone I'm lifting light and love for them, and I'll just, you know, think of them for a moment. But
that's not praying?
I mean, I suppose. You know, it depends on, you're right, there's a very broad definition of prayer. So I do. I pray. Mm. But I don't pray to a god.
Right.
I don't pray to anything that, you know, is what most people refer to as a god or God.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that I'm with it. Anti-theists are like Gamergate sometimes. They get really shitty.
Yeah. Well, anyways, I just saw that. So holier than thou. I was thinking, like, is that really, is it veering or has it always been there? That's the real question. And I say, I think about this often because people are talking about like, oh, all these different groups, fundamental or white evangelists are veering toward alt right. Are they veering? Are atheists really veering? I don't know. I don't know if I would agree with that. I would venture to say that what would have caused a veering, except for that they've always already been that way. Well,
here you go. So this says, by neglecting to address the darker currents, or like you said, they've always been, online atheism has unknowingly planted the seeds for alt-right's harvest. 3 years ago, Reddit's atheism subform, one of the largest community of atheists on the internet, was found to be the site's third most bigoted, meaning not just talented over dissuasibility, but actively supporting them. Third most. You know how fucking, like, I'm not even going to name them, but there's some subreddits that are absolutely horrible. And the atheism one was the third most bigoted and racist. So, yeah, I wouldn't say alt-right, because that was 3 years ago. You know what I'm saying? But I hadn't put the two together, and I often refer to myself as atheistic, secular humanist. But that sounds like that's got some negative connotations coming up, maybe.
Maybe so. All right. Well, I just thought it was interesting. I want to hear your thoughts, what you thought about that.
You should do the first one.
Oh, I should? Okay. Well, Heineken pulls its sometimes lighter is better at after racism claims. Now, claims, let's be real. There's no claim in this video, in this advertisement for light beer. A glass of beer is slid down a very, very, very long bar, as you know, like in like one of those long shots, and it slides past like three dark-skinned black women, one black dude, and finally lands in front of I would say certainly decidedly light-skinned woman.
I thought it was almost even a white woman.
I don't know if it was a white, if it was a white woman or a Latinx woman. It could have been whatever, but it was really the fucking, just the utmost, most egregious ever. And so they responded late Monday by pulling the ad from the internet. And here's the quote for you from the Heineken USA spokesman, Bjorn Trowley. He says, "While we feel the ad is referencing our Heineken light beer and that light beer is better than other high calorie options, we missed the mark, are taking the feedback to heart, and will use this to influence future campaigns." End quote.
I have never heard an apology where they take the first moment to pitch their brand. I've never heard an apology where it starts with a brand pitch.
Listen.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Listen.
And you know, the bartender puts on binoculars to look past all the dark black people, right? Like, has to like put on binoculars and look for the person at the end.
And
their apology starts by referencing
Bjorn,
the brand.
Go back to the drawing board. No, but I actually, low key, I think ad agencies are doing these ads on purpose now.
Oh, this seemed like internet trolling.
Yeah. And you know, I call this exposure trolling shit years ago when we first started this show. In fact, one of our earliest episodes is called that. It's called exposure trolling because it was bad then, but it was so jarring because it was so unusual. And now it just, every day it's something else, and I just can't help but recall it certainly seems to be effective, because what the fuck is everybody talking about today? Heineken goddamn light beer. And if that's your only
apology.
Goal, if that's your only goal is to make sure people are talking about Heineken light beer, well, you succeeded in that, and you get a side of, you know, Make America Great Again.
Hey, listen,
followers,
listen,
on top of it.
Listen, there were people that were like, when there was a boycott against Chick-fil-A for the Pruitt family's anti-homophobic and anti-LGBT donations, there was like a counter protest that was like, we're going to meet at the Chick-fil-A. We're going to buy six sandwiches each. Like, literally. So like here, you know, like you said, people that are like, oh, that was racist as shit. There's probably four more people like, yeah, I'm going to give that shit a try. I can see it on my own timeline. Like when I actually like fuck with trolls and like don't feed the trolls, I get it. But every once in a while, it's like, okay, I'm just going to like entertain you guys and like make you look like a bunch of idiots. Immediately, there's people that had been following me that exposed themselves, like let their slip show. And then there are people that newly follow me that are like super racist as shit, because it's like it gets attention to it. I'm like, okay, block, 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 block. But
Mm-hmm.
Exposure trolling, damn bastards. I mean, good lord.
Damn bastards. Am I doing the second one too?
Oh, there's another?
There's a second.
This
is actually a follow-up.
Yeah, see, Bob McNair, the Texans owner, he was in those NFL meetings when the tapes or the transcripts were leaked, and he was purported on tape saying, we can't let the inmates run the prison, in reference to the NFLPA and the NFL players, which are, as we know, largely black.
Yes. This is an update to that.
Yeah. So Bob McNair on Inmates in Prison comment, the main thing I regret is apologizing.
Now, I remember we gave him a flat negative 3,000.
Yeah,
for his
back to Heineken, it's just same thing.
Oh, I'm not even dignifying it
negative
with a grade.
You can't start an apology with pitching your brand.
Nope.
It negates everything that comes out your lips afterwards. But yeah, Bob McNair told the Wall Street Journal that he doesn't think he did anything wrong and doesn't think he should have been pressured into saying he was sorry. The main thing I regret is apologizing, Minotaur said. He insists the inmates he was referring to were not NFL players, but rather league executives who he felt had more control over major decisions than the owners. I really didn't have anything to apologize for. McNair said he sees nothing objectionable about the comments he made at the meeting and thinks if people were offended by it just means they didn't understand what he meant. It's business. It's a common expression, but the general public doesn't understand it, perhaps. Is it?
Is that what business? It is? It's just business?
I don't go into meetings and express views like that, he said. I never said that. He has no problem saying things that are not true. I never said that. He has... What? McNair denied what former Texan Duane Brown told PFC last year, that McNair had expressed dismay to the team in 2008 after the election of Barack Obama. Okay, he says, I never said that. Whatever. But yeah, the only thing he's sorry for is saying he was sorry and then explaining it again.
He's a liar.
His explanation in hindsight's an excuse, I guess.
Not even an excuse. He's just saying... He meant what he said. Actually, he's just saying what Nene says. I said what I said. I get bullied in school. I can't wait till I'm a cop so I can bully you, white people.
Hey. White people. God damn it. Fucking people. Oh, fucking white people. Sean Penn wrote a book, and in said book, wrote an epilogue, and had a little poem that took, I guess the book's Bob Honey Who Just Do Stuff. That's the name of the book, and I'm not going to go into it. But he wrote an epilogue, and it's a terrible poem. Enjoy, and I'm sorry. The warrior women bravely walk the walk. I really got to make sure you guys know this is Sean Penn. These are Sean Penn's words.
I don't even think
words.
You should read it. I'm going to be honest, Drew. I don't even think
okay.
You should read it. I honestly, it's
gross.
So disgusting and so gross. And I mean, I just...
He basically defends Louis C.K., Charlie mm-hmm. Rose,
yep.
What's with this Me Too, infantilizing the term of the day. It's a toddler's crusade. Like, literally...
It's really terrible.
It has
lost its sheen, S-H-E-E-N. It's really trash.
It's so bad. It's so bad. So Sean Penn, fuck you for writing the anti-Me Too.
Just trash.
So Michael Rapaport is the worst kind of white man alive.
This dude was on that Andy Cohen show and tried to read Kenya Moore or whatever her new name
yeah.
is.
Yeah. Burris, Kenya Moore.
No, it's Kenya, but
I'm not Burris, Kenya
I don't know what her new last name is, if she changed her name or not.
Yeah, the picture they got of Remy up here is just so bad looking.
He's bad looking.
He just looks terrible, though.
He is terrible.
Yeah, so here at the C-Wire. Dun, 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 dun. Michael Wright Rapport is a cool-ass white dude. Everyone knows a cool-ass white dude. They listen to hip-hop. They know how to speak urban. Sometimes they even embed themselves so deep in black culture that black people might start believing the cool-ass white dude is somehow immune to the disease of racism that manifests in many white people. Michael Rapport is like that. On Sunday, before appearing on an episode of Bravo's Watch What Happens Live, the half-chewed marshmallow center of a racism s'more post. Can I just do that sentence again? The half-chewed marshmallow center of a racism s'more posted and then deleted a picture of Real Housewives of Atlanta actress Kenya Moore alongside a photo of a gorilla.
Hmm.
Michael. Remy. I'm done calling you Michael. Remy. Because Remy went all fucking racist and shit too. During the episode, Rapport chided the former Miss USA by announcing, I didn't want to say it on live TV, but Kenya's feet are ashy as fuck. Them shits are ashy. I didn't want to say it on TV because I'm a gentleman, but pan down to them shits. She can cut glass with them shits.
Oh my God.
The washed-up actor who built a career on films like Zebrahead and Higher Learning has benefited from embracing by black audiences. Even his most recent gig as the fifth lead on Showtime's White Famous was based on his proximity to the star Jay Farrow. Wow.
In February, Rappaport, I'm just reading the way this is written. It's hilarious. In February, Rappaport took time out of his busy schedule of looking like death warmed over in a malfunctioning toaster oven to go on an extended rant about Janet Jackson. They called him phlegm-like fuckboy.
Wow.
He's trash. I can't stand that dude. He's really garbage.
Yeah.
Terrible. Ridiculous. The last thing I want to mention is that in Pittsburgh, a white woman who owns an art installation property called The Last Billboard. They have artists that are able to put up words and things on the billboard for installations. And Alicia Wormsley's text that she put up, she's a prominent Pittsburgh artist and a great artist, generally speaking, says, there are black people in the future.
So I want to make sure I understand. There's a woman whose art installation is basically a billboard and allows people, a different artist, to put up words and do things with this billboard space. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the artist, a well-known black woman in Pittsburgh, put up simply, there are black people in the future.
Correct. The artist, Alicia, will be part of a public panel discussion about the text and its removal hosted by the Kelly Strayhorn Theater in the next few weeks. More information to come. I did get some more information, however, because someone had emailed Eve Pickler, who's the white woman who owns the property, or the conglomerate that owns the property. She runs it. She says, this is what she responds. My inbox is being flooded with people accusing me of being a racist. Which she spelled R-A-S-C-I-S-T, for asking you to remove the sign. As you know, I requested that you remove it because other people in the community felt the sign was racist, which she spelled correctly there, and were offended by it. So here we are. Art has caused friction. Perhaps that's what you wanted, but it shouldn't be aimed at me. We have worked together productively on this project for almost 8 years now, an arrangement which has added tremendously to the cultural fabric of the neighborhood. Over that time, we have never questioned any of the artistic statements you have made. This is all very disappointing. If a full community conversation is to be had, then that's what should be focused on. If you agree to sponsor and conduct a community discussion where all parties are invited, and by that I mean everyone you have reached out to, everyone who is offended by it, the administration, the press, and anyone else that is held in a public venue in East Liberty, such as the Kelly Strayhorn. And if the end result of that discussion is agreement that the sign should go up again, we will be the first to give you the go-ahead. Eve Pickler.
Wow.
White women are garbage. I just want everybody to know it. And also, all these white people complaining about the actual concept that there will be black people in the future. Fuck y'all. Like, seriously. It's the epitome of a snowflake to be like, oh no, how dare you even say that there'll be black people in the future? It doesn't say black people are the future. It doesn't say there are only black people in the future. It literally just says, in the future, black people will exist. That's offensive to you? Fuck off.
And the shit they put up, it's so, like, this isn't art. Things we need at a waffle shop, a magician, one talk show host, animal masks, a zookeeper. That's the billboard by the waffle shop, June whatever. 7th. It's time to stop fighting. It's time to fight.
I don't even want to even get, I'm just so irritated by it. I wanted you to mention the show.
We've tried everything.
Honey is the one who, Sarah Honey Young, if y'all don't know, amazing.
Oh, she's in Pittsburgh.
Artist, she? Yeah. I mean, there's like designer, web designer.
There's one up here from a 10-year-old boy about a ghost. Like, and like, let's just for a second tangent. And Honey's amazing and awesome. We can get back to her. There will be black people in the future is a, in my opinion, a statement about the number of sci-fi, fantasy, utopian, dystopian, doesn't matter, this earth, what earth, next earth, there's always a fucking dearth of black people. It's always white people. Like, y'all, we all know that the demographics are not going in that way in our lifetime. So why do we think in 100 lifetimes it's going to be fucking white as shit? I just don't get it. So the comment there will be black people in the future is because there never are in sci-fi adventures in the future.
There won't be.
I'm just saying there never is. So that's no. The like the billboards, I'm saying it's not even not offensive. It's like,
it's a commentary.
Yes.
And a necessary one.
That's my point.
I know. I'm agreeing with you.
It's so racist. Take it down.
Take it down. I'm so, my feefies are hurt. Oh, it's racist. They're black people in the future. How dare you? Oh my God.
Okay, so I apologize in advance.
What are you apologizing for?
If you write stupid commercial, I'll skip it for a second.
What are you apologizing for?
The world's worst choir.
The world's worst choir?
Yep.
It's got to be white people.
Talent show audition. FBC Senior Adult Choir.
Oh, no. This is, I'm an Eminem. Why are they saying Eminem?
Eminem.
Eminem. That's my New Zealand accent.
The average age has to be 70. There's not a non-gray hair there.
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
Look. Nope. If you had one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted, one moment, would you capture it or just let it slip? Yo.
Yo. Get the fuck out of here.
That's the choir leader, by the way.
Oh my God, this is so bad. They're not even like singing it together. They're literally singing on the downbeat. What's happening right now? Oh, God. No, no. 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 Do they know what they're singing? What in the world? Oh my gosh.
Imagine your grandma singing this shit. Dude,
no, no, thank you. Hey y'all, good night. I'm so mad at you. How much more of there is this? I'm sorry, folks.
I said so.
This is terrible.
Hey, all right now, fellows.
What is this? What is this? Nope, nope, nope. I'm out. That's it. The show's over, folks. That's the end. I quit. I'm done. That's it. Don't ya. Get the fuck out of here.
Worst choir.
Oh my God.
Oh man. I know Rob plays white people playing black music. That is so bad.
That's terrible.
That was like,
that's really terrible.
The worst choir ever.
I'm sorry to everybody. Well, now it's back to everyone's favorite new segment, Yum Yum or Onion.
I finally got a couple right.
So close the show notes so you
I'm
can't
done.
See.
I didn't, right. I didn't scroll right. it down.
All right, here we go. Are you ready?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay. Breast cancer page scrubbed from Women's Health website report.
That's the only headline?
That's the headline.
True.
It is true. Yes, the health department has scrubbed the breast cancer page from its website on Women's Health. So that happened.
For what?
I guess they're not concerned about it anymore. They've just...
But, okay.
Yep.
State of the Union. Yep. I had a tweet about that, about... I talked to you about a friend of ours that...
The content was not mobile friendly and very rarely used, they said. So they just, you know... Who needs it?
It's not mobile friendly.
Get rid of it.
And very, very used. This friend of mine was talking about their racist ass dad right before Easter. Mm-hmm. And like totally like Fox, Hannity, Limbaugh, like total indoctrination and shit. And I was kind of having, I was pushing him pretty hard. And he kept coming back to, but I love my dad. And I kept coming back to, but your coddling of your dad is fucking up your girl's future. He's got three girls.
And what did he say to that?
He's like, he had nothing. And I wish I could remember what you said, but the best one is to say, what are you going to say in 20 years when they don't have autonomy over their bodies? What are you going to tell them you did? You just let your dad vote fucking Trump and be a total piece of shit? Okay.
Cool. Apparently. All right. You ready for some more?
Yes.
White House reviewing proposal that would roll back protections for threatened species.
I think that's true because of hunting.
That is true. And they are thinking about rolling them back. Which is terrible, of course. Their proposal's obscure name, removal of blanket 4D rule, refers to protections covering approximately 300 animal and plant species, such as the northern spotted owl and manatee, that are at risk of becoming endangered. The Fish and Wildlife Service has for 40 years used the blanket rule to cover the majority of threatened species, the category considered at risk of endangerment under the Endangered Species Act.
And let's just, for a while, bald eagles went from, you know, very endangered to threatened. And there's places now where I actually see them. Like, wow, bald eagle, that's kind of cool. And now people are able to fucking hunt them. Yay. Yeah,
that's awesome. Okay, let's see. Man who never missed Ally McBeal back in the day joins Trump legal team.
That's the Onion.
That is the Onion. Yes, that is the Onion.
Ally McBeal. That's a little too far out there.
Let's see. USDA secretary accused of siding with industry over science in new report.
So true.
That one is very true. Absolutely. Sonny Perdue. The USDA is siding with Purdue in a industry over science report.
Of course.
Scientists are concerned.
Purdue's right.
Mm-hmm. EPA rolls back emission standards to increase consumer choice over type of apocalyptic hellscape Earth will become.
That's only because of the end of apocalyptic and that onion.
That's true. You're right. That is onion. Trump takes credit over border crossing, says tougher action is needed.
Takes credit for, like, lowering them?
That's the whole headline. Trump takes credit over border crossings.
That's true.
Yes, that is true. Tougher is needed, though. Let's see. Trump's new best friend is MyPillow founder Mike Lindell.
I'm going to say that's true.
That is true.
That is true. Why is it? I'm just going to say, folks, a friend of mine has a MyPillow. It felt like a piece of shit. It was like, it literally was like, you know, the foam that people like jump into when they're doing like trying to do backflips for the first time. And there's like a big foam pile. It felt like that shit if you cut it up into tiny pieces and stuffed it in a pillow.
Well, MyPillow founder Mike Lindell took a break from battling an F rating by the Better Business Bureau to chat with a commander-in-chief at Mar-a-Lago over Easter weekend. Trump told Lindell that he uses one of his Minnesota-based company's product. The president shook my hand and told me, "You're doing a great job, Michael." He also said he's sleeping great on his MyPillow. I told him, "People come up to me all the time and tell me what a great job you're doing and that you're in their prayers. It was an honor to be at Mar-a-Lago on Easter weekend."
Is he going to stock all his hotels with MyPillow?
These two legit look like they have each other's thumbs up their asses, like Little Boy Blue style.
Yeah.
Let's see. John Bolton warns war with North Korea won't be a cakewalk like Iraq.
Oh, that's true.
That is the Onion.
That's the Onion?
That's the Onion.
Oh, he said who? What was the name?
John Bolton. It's the right guy, but he wouldn't say a cakewalk like Iraq. It was a joke. Let's see.
But that sounds like the administration. It does.
That's the tricky one. That's the tricky part. Let's see. I think I just have like one more maybe. Let me see. Trump gets testy as national security team warns of risks of Syria withdrawal.
I'm going to say that's true.
That is true. And the last one, Dr. Evil fired from the Trump administration.
That's Onion only because I know that he did an SNL spoof.
He did do an SNL spoof.
I didn't get to watch that. We probably recorded it, though.
I'm sure it's down there. Let's see. I think.
In his administration, it seems like every week someone new loses their job.
And believe you want to play that?
I'm playing it.
Was just fired by Trump moments ago. This literally just happened. And we're lucky enough to get an exclusive interview with them right now. Hello? Are you there? Dr. Evil?
No, it's Adam Levine. Of course it's Dr. Evil, numbnuts.
I gotta say, I had no idea that you were part of the Trump administration. What exactly did you do there?
Well, naturally, I was gonna be Secretary of Evil. But Steve Bannon got that job.
Right. Evil. Well, what did you end up doing?
Well, I was more of an ideas guy, really.
What kind of ideas?
The wall, that was all me.
The wall,
but I wanted it to be a moat filled with spiky blowfish. And I didn't want the Mexicans to pay for it. I wanted Alec Baldwin to pay for it.
Okay, well, what about Trump's army in space?
You mean the Space Force?
Was that you?
All the most evil stuff was me.
Even deporting dreamers?
No, Jimmy, even I have my limits. I'm evil, but I'm not a monster.
We'll stop it there anyway. So, yeah, Mike Myers dusted off Dr. Evil for the occasion. We did really good this week. You only got one wrong, babe.
Not bad.
Good job.
Some were a little bit more obvious.
Good on you.
But Cakewalk got me. this is a little miscellaneous segment that I think just happened recently. So the NFL's trolling us at this point. There's only way to explain that Robert Griffin III, RG3, has returned to the league while Colin Kaepernick is still banging on the front door. Kaepernick, they said the guy, and this is Jason Reed, NFL might as well put a sign on its office that reads, Kaepernick is never getting back in. Ravens, Baltimore Ravens announced Wednesday they've signed Griffin, a one-time superstar quarterback whose rapid career downturn was a stunner. After waiting all last season for an offer that never came, Griffin got a one-year deal to be a starter to Joe Flacco's backup. Deal to be starter, Joe Flacco's backup. That makes no sense. It's a poorly written sentence. The Ravens hope they'll succeed where both the Redskins and Browns have failed. If they rebuild Griffin's game, if the 2000 Heisman Trophy winner and NFL's 2012 AP Offensive Rookie of the Year makes it all the way back, the Ravens could have a potential long-term replacement already on the roster for Flacco. For this part, Griffin is thankful to be wanted again. The Ravens are blessed, blah, 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 blah. There is a lot of, obviously, media scrutiny about Kaepernick and the fact that Griffin got hired. And I want to see what Griffin said about it. He said, I can't see it.
Oh, okay. Well, anyways, I do think that's trash and RG3 sucks. So I'll just leave that there.
I wouldn't say he sucks, but here's what he says. The situation is probably the most sticky situation in the entire league, but it's not my job to comment on it, Griffin said. If you look at the stats, if every decision was stats-based, there'd be a lot of quarterbacks who are on the street right now playing football over some of the guys who have been signed in the past. The bottom line is, for me, this is a blessing and all I can really focus on. I can't try to focus on what's going on with anybody else. This comment about stats is some fucking side jab, though. Why throw that in there? Like, yeah, I know he's got good stats, but he shouldn't be in the league either.
Because okay. He's a fucking... Listen, RG3. Don't get me started about RG3.
He said, I don't want to comment, but then just like made like a silent, like almost dog whistle comment.
Yeah, he's trash too. Garbaggio.
All right, on to entertainment news, yeah?
TV, yes, and whatnot. Entertainment TV news. So I just saw this really cool article I'll just share with folks about the 23 times that Captain Raymond Holt was the greatest part of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, because he is the greatest part of Brooklyn
really
Nine-Nine
is.
And y'all Under y'all Brower know I hate hilarious. Cop shows. I don't watch any cop shows. I don't watch anything that cops are centered on or that stories about. I don't watch any of those shows. But this show is so funny that it's hard to not watch it, because and mostly
Andre
because
Brower
of him.
Because yeah.
Andre Brower is so funny as Captain Holt, and it's really hilarious.
His deadpan, and he did what who could do it better than anybody else? That got Will Ferrell was pretty good at it. Daryl Hammond was good at it. Being deadpan.
Deadpan,
like being the funny person by being just not.
Will Ferrell does it. That's
what I'm
saying.
Will Ferrell's really well at it, but being just deadpan. And that's Andre Brower. I don't think he's ever not been deadpan on the show for however many seasons. It's hilarious. But what are get us the top five moments.
The top five?
Yeah.
I don't think it's like ranked. It's just a bunch of lists of them.
Oh, all right. Well, give us three or four.
I mean, it's hard because it's like showing when he pretended to be straight while undercover. The quotes are, you keep talking
funny.
About her thigh gap. That's my favorite part of a woman. There's nothing more intoxicating than the clear absence of a penis.
See, you could read a couple more.
When he realized his dog had been replaced with an imposter. You're not Cheddar. You're just some common bitch.
Okay.
Let's see. There was one more up here that I thought would be funny.
Just the other week, he's calling his husband and he's leaving a message. And he goes, it's Raymond Holt. H-O. He starts spelling Holt to his husband.
Yeah. When he said, let's see. I think it was. Wait, where I lost it. We talked about when he would change the color of the sky. Gina says, "Would you tell the sky to stop being so blue?" "Yes, I wish it were tan." "What? It's my favorite color. It's no nonsense." When he was very awake about grammar, "I must say this is going considerably better than when I came out to my colleagues. They were not, as the kids say, awake." Jake says, "Do you mean woke?" "I did mean woke, but it's grammatically incoherent."
It's grammatically incoherent. Again, his deadpan delivery is too good.
It's very funny. So anyways, check Andre Brow on that show. It's very funny.
So you were telling me this earlier today that MoviePass is...
Yes, we were retalking. We had reported a little bit about MoviePass and AMC getting into a little tussle. So there was some news today about that.
A war of muscle and AMC lost, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. I guess AMC folded. The standoff between AMC and MoviePass ended. This is reported in EW.com. After previously pulling its movie subscription service from several of the most popular AMC locations, MoviePass has relented and added them back to its list of the available theaters, EW has confirmed. Back in January, MoviePass, which allows subscribers to see one movie per day for as low as $6.95 a month, abruptly stopped servicing 10 large AMC theaters in Los Angeles, New York, and other major cities. To help its own costs, MoviePass has sought reduced ticket prices from theater chains, a request that AMC has reportedly refused to accommodate. AMC also threatened to take legal action against MoviePass late August when the service slashed its monthly price from $9.95 from $15 to $50. At that time, the theater chain called MoviePass a small fringe payer with an unsustainable business model. Jab. Well, they're still here, but they did add them all back in. So there you go. Bang. So this I thought was interesting. Hollywood actresses to New York eliminate tip credit. New York waitresses to actresses, shut up. Last week, a group of 16 actresses, including Sarah Jessica Parker, Jane Fonda, Natalie Portman, Lily Tomlin, you'll see a trend. Amy Poehler, Reese Witherspoon, Brie Larson, Deborah Messing, Ashley Judd, and Sarah Silverman decided to take their campaign against sexual harassment to New York, sending a letter to New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, urging him to eliminate the state's tip credit for restaurant workers. They wrote, "Relying on tips creates a more permissive work environment where customers feel entitled to abuse women in exchange for service." The actresses called for a higher minimum wage instead.
We talked about this earlier, yeah. And the tip credit allows New York restaurateurs to pay their employees $2 an hour, mm-hmm. and they're saying this is unfair and you need to pay them a minimum wage.
And unfair in the context that it makes us more sexually...
But it sure removed a lot of agency, I'll say that.
Yeah, but this week...
Did they talk to like waitresses? Was this
I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
But this week, hundreds of mostly female restaurant professionals, mostly from New York, fired back with a letter telling the actresses to leave their tips alone. The workers are some of 14,000 New York restaurant professionals and supporters urging Cuomo to leave the tip system and the tip credit alone. The letter stated to the celebrity women who recently criticized the full service restaurant industry from over 500 men and women, or women and men who work in it. "Thank you for your concern, but we don't need your help and we're not asking to be saved. You've been misled that we earn less than minimum wage and that we're somehow helpless victims of sexual harassment. These untruths are the report. Are the product of the Restaurant Opportunity Center, which does not represent us or the thousands of our colleagues who stand with us. We don't have the platform you have, so we're forced to organize online to defend the tipping system against myths spread by its critics. We get to offer our opinions on your movies. You get to offer your opinions on the food we serve and our service, but you don't have the right to do is dictate how we are paid. Servers and bartenders have never been paid the same as everyone else, and we're okay with that. We are paid based on our sales and service. We're guaranteed minimum wage and our tips let us earn much more than that. Our bad behavior happens in every industry. Hollywood celebrities should know better than most that sexual harassment happens everywhere. The people who are pushing for the change in the restaurant industry are exploiting those isolated stories of people who have suffered injustices and making it out to be the industry's or the tipping system's fault. That's not true. We're bartenders and servers by choice, just like you choose to be actresses. The industry gives us flexibility and the current tipping system gives us opportunity to earn great money with less than full-time hours. We respect your profession. Now it's time for you to respect ours.
So I referenced my time in a New Orleans top restaurant, one of the Ralph Brennan Group restaurants, mm-hmm. and it was like team service, white kind of like glove type deal, like, you know, you got the Amuse Bouche, the palate cleanser, all that kind of horse shit. And I bet over a year it had to have been at least a $50,000 a year job, and primarily, like, again, I was only claiming 10% of the tips, but you know,
you do quite better than that. And I wouldn't work fucking shit during the summer. I'd work like 3-4 shifts a week. I had a lot of time off in the summer. It was closed during the entire Mardi Gras. Like literally, like, cause it was too, like, Mardi Gras is people drinking like Bud Light and fucking looking for like, you know, beignet trucks and shit. They're not coming into like $100 a plate fucking place. No. So they would just close down. So yeah. I had like Mardi Gras off. Like fucking A. Like it was a really good job. I had no complaints about that job and I made plenty of money. Plenty of money.
Plenty.
And I didn't need my minimum wage discussed.
Well, I just think it's just like talks about people just jumping into being organizers thinking they can just do whatever the fuck they want and that organizing has anything to do with what they think needs to be done.
Yeah, but like there's
that's
a,
not how that shit works.
There's a restaurant, I'm meeting you. I don't know if you want me to put it. There's a restaurant workers association with over 14,000 people. They could have pulled them. They literally could have just called them.
They could have.
Just call them. Hey, is this what you want? Oh, no? All right. Sorry. I'll turn you back up because there's a sound with this, isn't it?
Yeah. So Cardi B's album is coming out this week and next week, I think, Tuesday or something like that. And so she's on this like full court press. She just had a new album that premiered, a new video that premiered for Bardi A. Cardi on during Love and Hip Hop. She has a new single, Be Careful, which I actually really, really like. Maybe I'll play it later. That came out. She is the musical guest on Saturday Night Live tomorrow night, and she also is going to be co-hosting, not just a guest, but co-hosting the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, I think on Monday or Tuesday. So I saw her doing all of this stuff and like really going out here to promote this album, and I was like, I wonder what success looks like. Like, what is your, you know, what does an album release success look like? Because it used to be, you know, you'd lead up to this date and the date comes out and it's like, how many units did you use? How many right. CDs did you sell? How many,
and
you know, whatever.
It used to be millions used in
to
a
be,
week.
Yeah, it used to be a lot. So obviously with digital, that's changed the game completely. And I had posted on Facebook about it and my friend Merv, shout out to you, Merv, sent me this video, which was from Vice News, about this R&B artist is using data to find his fans because Merv said that the success is you want as much downloads as you can possibly get on all data. These streaming services so that you can get the data, know where your fans are, know where you need to go tour so you could actually make your money. And I was like, whoa, my mind was blown. I was like, that makes perfect sense, like data mining for dollars. And then I came across this video and we started watching. You were like, nope, let's play it on the show. So let's play it on the show.
Do it.
Here we go.
Last year, 22-year-old R&B singer Brent Faiyaz caught a break. He was featured on the song Crew, which ended up getting 67 million YouTube views and a Grammy nomination. A record deal would seem like the logical next step, and all the big labels, Atlantic, Interscope, and Epic, offered one. But Brent and his manager turned them down.
What were they offering?
Well, I know the highest offer we got was kind of like
this is the manager
a $250,000 advance. And it was like a $300,000 recording budget for album one. I always said it was never about the money. It was always about the terms. I look at everything from 100% of a pie. So when people say, well, industry standard for a new artist is a 18% royalty. And they're going to say 18% royalty is very high. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, 18% out of 100?
What are you doing getting 82% of my music? You know what I mean? Like, that stuff just don't make no sense.
Brent and Ty are comfortable with trading more work for more control. So comfortable that they broke the music industry taboo against opening their books and showed us what they make and how they make it.
It's bound to happen.
They began by incorporating Lost Kids, LLC, and investing $30,000 out of their own pockets to record Brent's debut album. They then went on a 3-month tour using streaming data to guide the way.
Chance the Rapper.
Brent and Ty were inspired by Chance the Rapper and his partner, Pat, the manager, Corcoran, who found wealth and acclaim on their own terms. It's something music attorney Richard Grable has seen much more of over the past 2 years. Instead of looking for deals, artists come to him for advice on how to avoid labels.
Streaming changed everything. You can be a moderately successful indie artist having a couple of 100,000 streams on each track. You're not going to make much money from that. But at that level, if things break the right way, you can play large clubs and small theaters and make money. Artists have to be smarter, and they have to tour more. And they have to do more to keep making sure that the fans come and that they not only pay for a ticket, but, you know, buy a T-shirt.
Yeah, no, definitely. We need to know about all analytics, all data, because there has been several ladies that's filed immunity to Pandora.
Beauty ain't no issue for someone like you.
In January, Brent made $25,350 from streaming on Spotify and Apple Music, which pay out 0.0035 of a dollar and 0.071 of a dollar, respectively. Time mines the data for those streams to find out exactly where and when a show will sell out, spending roughly $18 a day on ads targeted to those areas.
The data tells me what the demand is in the market. So I just know in certain markets how streaming correlates to like how many tickets I potentially can sell. I'm looking at my Spotify and my SoundCloud analytics, like the top 50 markets. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing ads based on those top 50 markets. I was spending money there because that's what the data already told me.
Spotify's data not only highlights basic fan metrics, but it also tells artists specifically where their super fans are. These are fans that have streamed the artist's music for 45 days in a row.
Wow.
Spotify targets them with updates about upcoming shows and ticket pre-sales and turns all of this data over to the artist for free.
Wow.
In Philadelphia, Brent has 13,600 listeners and 3,186 super fans. Ty used those numbers to sell out the venue and earn almost $4,000.
Wow.
And in Baltimore, there were 10,000 listeners and 5,743 superfans. That turned into $5,000. After 17 tour stops and royalties from song placements, they walk away with around $30,000 a month. Ty takes 20%. After the data showed him there were strong fan bases in Europe, Ty was able to extend the tour and sell out stops in London, Paris, and Berlin.
Wow.
I didn't want to be indie, you know what I mean? It was like, I really wanted to come out like stunting on niggas, but like the indie route kind of chose me.
Hmm.
You couldn't get over that 18%.
No.
I can't blame you.
Wow.
Would you give anybody anywhere close to 80% of your work?
Pat was able to create. So for me, I'm a competitor. So when I see that we can do this and put up points on the board and get nominated for a Grammy and be a part of those type of records, I'm impressed by that. You know what I'm saying?
Wow, that's pretty impressive.
He said the best deal was $250, mm-hmm. and then
a $300,000 to make the album. But you have to. It costs a lot to make an album.
They spent $30,000
more than that.
No.
If you want guests and stuff.
They just said they spent $30,000.
Well, they did. Yeah.
So the best deal was a $250,000 advance and 18%. They're making $300,000 a year and keeping 100%.
Yep, that's true.
You know? And like, again, that Spotify money probably was like quite a bit because they're only making like $4,000 or $5,000 a stop. You can't do but, you know, and that's sales. That's not profit from those tour stops. You got to pay for all the fucking other things. And the one thing was 7 cents a play.
Yeah.
He's got thousands of people playing shit. That adds up.
Clearly, definitely does.
Super fans adds up. Which one was 7%? Or 7 cents? You remember which one was the second one? Spotify or Pandora?
Apple Beats Music or whatever.
Dang, I don't have that. If I did, I'd be playing Nelly. Help him get out that Nelly. Hole.
Fuck Nelly. So I got kind of obsessed with a couple of...
You get obsessed with things often.
I do. A couple of musicians. So the first one is this dude, PJ Morton, who's from New Orleans originally. He's got a bunch of albums, but he had this really acclaimed album called Gumbo that came out about a year and a half ago. And he decided to do the entire album unplugged. So it's a live version of his own album, which is really interesting. He has a lot of dope guest stars. So I'm going to play two of the songs. The first one is called Religion, and I swear for God, I think Black People Wrote It About You Use. Black You Use Wrote It About You Use. So I'm going to just play that one. Lecrae is on it, and then I'll play the next one, and then that'll take me into my next other obsession.
Well, love. The rules I tend to bend do not define me. So either get beside me or Satan get behind me. You let her point at all the wrongs, right? That's a day job. That's a long night, but it's show life. What's the point that I'm missing? Tell me the point of your mission. Now I don't know why you so cold. I saw you grow.
you got nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it, yeah. Nothing to do with it. Nothing to do with it. That's what you were told. Let's just be honest.
So that's pretty good, yeah?
Yeah, it's not bad.
He's pretty dope. Okay, so then he does a cover of, as you know, I love the Bee Gees. And my favorite Bee Gees song is How Deep Is Your Love. I just think it's one of the most beautiful songs ever written. Every cover of it I adore. And so he does a cover of this song. And then this girl's voice comes on. I'm going to play it. So here's PJ Morton from Gumball Unplugged. How Deep Is Your Love.
Know your eyes in the morning sun. I feel you touch me in the pouring rain. And the moment that you wandered from me, I wanna feel my arms again. And you come to me on a summer breeze. Keep me warm in your love, then you softly. And it's me.
This girl. Where that girl came from. Her name is Yeba. I never heard of her before in my whole damn life. And so now I'm completely obsessed with them. I don't know what their pronoun is, so I'll just use them. So they have this other song called Evergreen. So I'll play a little bit of that. Let's see here.
I kissed my penny and I threw it in. I prayed I'd keep my soul. Went down to the river where the water bends. The only place I know. Oh, I can see the forest for the trees. So will you wait for me?
Anyways,
we gonna fuck to that. Put that on the list. End this podcast. Let's go. Come on, let's go.
Well, I guess that's the end of the podcast.
Damn.
That's it. Play us out. Hi, everybody. High five.